Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the July 20th, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, thanks for tuning in today. I am in a great mood today and anxious to spend this next hour talking with you about our nation's space program. The Olympics are underway in London. NFL training camp has begun this week, and we are now 1 week away from what could be the biggest space-related news event of the year, I think even topping the recent SpaceX mission to the International Space Station. Don't know what I'm talking about? Well, you will soon find out as we spend most of the hour giving you an in-depth preview with the help of NASA's Ashvin Vasavada from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And, of course, we'll review the latest forecast for launch activity from the Cape. Plus, of course, you're welcome to join in on the program today with your questions or comments about our space program. Give us a call at 768-1240. The area code is 321 if you need it. Or if you'd prefer, you can send an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, yeah, I am in a great mood, partly because my Vikings are back at training camp in Mankato, Minnesota, where my father went to college, I might add, and partly because I'm really looking forward to what's going to happen at Mars next weekend, but mostly because in the studio hanging out with me today is my good friend Anthony Dugnan Cabrera. Anthony and I worked together for a few years at space.com. In fact, I actually worked for him for a time, and well, we did go through a lot together professionally and personally as we attempted to survive the dot-com roller coaster that we went through at the turn of the century. That's kind of weird saying turn of the century for the 21st. And it was Anthony, by the way, who was my first call on that horrible day in February 2003 when it became clear to me that we had lost Columbia. So we've been through a lot together. Anthony, it's great to see you again, have you on the show today.
Great to see you, Jim.
Now, Anthony, you're only making a brief appearance here. We're not going to, you know, put you through this thing through the whole hour. But
I have no script, thank God.
That's right. That's good. Well, as it turns out, Anthony, being here this weekend is a sad coincidence because a lot of people know this past week we lost Sally Ride, first female astronaut for the United States, and a two-time shuttle veteran, and really a great person. And Anthony and I, as it turns out, both worked for Sally when we were at space.com together. Sally, I think, actually was your interview and hired you. Sally, Lou
yep.
Dobbs hired
yep.
me, but I worked for Sally and spent a lot of time together. And I was just curious, Anthony, you're here. Talk about what it was like to work with her and what were your thoughts on her passing.
About her passing, it was tragic. And I think for anyone who loses someone and see someone goes through a long-term illness, and to do it with dignity and in the privacy of her life, it was very moving.
Yeah.
And I did think back of the times when she interviewed me, and it was she asked me, even she knew I did not come from a science background, and or a space science reporting background.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, and yeah, it's true. I'm very mainstream and about communicating complex ideas to a larger audience, and so she asked me those questions. Because she knew I didn't have that background, she specifically asked me questions about why it was important to educate the public about the importance of space exploration.
Yeah.
She was you could tell she was very detail-oriented. I think she loved the fact that the idea of space.com seemed like a jumping-off point in many ways for what she would do later with her work on science education for kids.
Mm-hmm.
We had Space Kids.
Yeah.
And Brenda Wilson actually did go on to work with her. Brenda Wilson was the executive producer of Space Kids. It was a tangent site for space.com aimed at science, aimed at kids, elementary and junior high school kids. Sally, her presence in the office – she would come over, and if she saw the smallest factual error, mm-hmm. she would point it out. And I think some people were a little frustrated by that. I go, no. See, it's the attention to details that really makes something excellent, that you want the whole thing to be true. I think that's a part of the legacy that she left with Space when she was there at that time.
So many people have focused on the fact that she was a private person, and we'll talk about her coming out in a moment, but the privacy to me, it reminded me a lot of Neil Armstrong in being such a private individual and kind of that background. But the phrase I liked that I saw in a lot of the writings was that she was publicly private, which was true because one-on-one in the office, there was nothing quiet or introspective about her. I remember her smile keeps coming back to me. I mean, she was always smiling, always happy, always wanting to work together and have a good time doing it while you were doing that attention detail and while she was a kind of a firm manager too in a way.
Oh yeah, she had a firm hand. She really wanted everything to be exact, accurate, and most of all, telling the mission, moving the history forward. That was the important part of it. It was like, don't just highlight the past. Explain how it's working on the future. We went out one night. Lou, Sally, and the head of ad sales at the time. We were on 47th Street, where the original or the second Space.com headquarters was.
Yeah.
And we were having drinks, and it was weird. I was a little nervous because it was the first time I had a casual hanging out with Sally.
Mm-hmm.
And then we spent the evening like joking about how much trouble men are, you know. And it was just really, really. It was funny to see this side of her.
Yeah.
Very open, great sense of humor, and to the publicly private aspect of it. No, she didn't shy away from her role in American history and what she felt was her responsibility.
Right.
And it wasn't kind of important what people thought of her or knew about her private life. Maybe, you know, that she was happy, you know, that would be important. But I think she wanted people to keep the focus. She was the messenger, and the message was improving the education and of science. Not only for young people, but specifically for girls and young women, and she would like to keep the focus on that.
And she really kept so focused and concentrated on that through her whole career. I just in all of my work with her after Space.com for a time when I was with the Space Foundation, the Sally Science, you know, Sally Ride for Science program, and all that. It made a difference. I mean, I could in the stories we did, and in the stories we've heard since, and even from some of the fellow female astronauts that have been flying on the space shuttle, were flying on the shuttle, you could tell that she made a difference well beyond the idea that she was, you know, someday going to be the answer to some trivia question about the space program. It was such a important thing. You know, I wanted to tell you a quick story too. I remember this was in the year 2000 or so, and we're, you know, politically correct and all that. It's getting stronger all the time. I remember how she made us very conscious, and I got to admit to some biased here, very conscious about the use of what pronouns to use in your space program. Is it the manned space program?
Piloted.
Or is it the piloted space program?
Yes. Yes.
You know, and I even remember, and the only time it got to me was there was one time I think we were writing something about, you know, back for the manned Apollo program or something like that. And actually, I think you were the one that made me change it to the piloted, and because Sally wanted it changed, which was probably the right thing to do, but always drove me crazy because only men flew in Apollo. But maybe that was what was wrong with the whole thing in the first place, that maybe we should have had some women flying back then.
Yeah, and, you know, those are really funny arguments. We used to have a lot of those, now that you mention it.
We got about a minute or so before we kick you off for the hour. Talk about her coming out. You know, it was done posthumously. A lot of people made a lot of stink about it, both positive and negative. What's your take on that?
I think coming out for everyone is a personal choice. And I understand the reasoning that, yes, she was a role model, not just for young women and girls. She was a role model for anyone who has a dream to break through the glass ceiling, to do anything that was momentous. But you cannot... You cannot drag someone out of the closet if that is not what they wish to be.
Right.
People have their dignity, and they have to make their own decision.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, Anthony, good words to send. And thanks for – Anthony's going to stick around for the hour and listen in, but we're going to keep his microphone off at his request. We're going to take our first break, be back more. We're talking with Ashwin Vasavada from the JPL about the Mars landing next week. Give us a call, 321-768-1240, or an email at spacetalkingaol.com. Stay tuned, I'm Jim Banky. You are listening to Space Talk here on WMMB.
If you- you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240. The number to call to participate in the program today. You can also send us an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. Well, 1 week from tonight, the Mars Science Laboratory, or MSL as we like to call it, also known by the name of its rover Curiosity, will attempt to land on the red planet. Actual touchdown expected about 1:36 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, early Monday morning, August 6th. That'll be late the evening, Sunday night on the 5th on the West Coast. The probe was launched in November of last year from right here at the Cape. Has spent the past 8 months or so making the cruise to Mars. The MSL team performed a small course correction maneuver last night. Everything appears to be going well at this point. And so the deputy project scientist for Curiosity from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Dr. Ashwin Vasavada, who, by the way, first appeared on this program back in October of 2010 when we were still a year away from launch. He's joining us today. Here we are nearly 2 years later with the probe now about 1.4 million miles from Mars. Ashwin calling in today from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Ashwin, good to see you again, sir. Happy to have you on board.
Hi, Jim. Great to be here.
Good, good. Well, okay, so you were on the show in October 2010. We were a year away from launch. We talked about the mission and the probe and all of that. We had a great launch last November. Mars Science Laboratory on its way to Mars, cruising along, doing the work you need to be doing, and now here we are a week from the big moment. What's it like out there? What are you feeling?
As you can imagine, we're, I don't know, I guess I like to say we're confident but nervous.
Yeah, I bet.
Everything we work on, you know, comes down to next Sunday night, and even as scientists, you know, everything we work on after the landing, all the science we want to do depends on the landing, so we're just biting our nails, but also really excited to get on to business.
Yeah, now we read about the course correction last night. Are you as the science team involved in those kind of things as well, or is there a sort of a mission operations team that handles that?
You know, it's primarily the mission operations team, the crews team, as we call it. And in fact, now it's transitioning over to the entry, descent, and landing team. We're really on final approach now, and so they're handing things off to the entry, descent, and landing team, which is a team, of course, that's worked for almost 10 years just for that, you know, 7 minutes and the few days before it. So they're working hard. And as scientists, we just contribute only if they have an issue about where the landing site may end up. So we might indicate whether we'd like to move a little closer to the mound inside Gale Crater or further away, depending on the navigation.
Yeah, and that's what I think I read on the statement this morning on the NASA website, that your course correction adjusted for like a 13-mile, I don't want to call it an error, but a 13-mile correction and where you wanted to go to pinpoint exactly where you wanted to fly. And I guess you have a couple of more opportunities to do that as you get a little closer?
Yeah, that's right. We have up to six opportunities, and even maybe even one after that if we needed it. And these are all planned well before launch. You can only aim so well from Florida, and,
sure,
and we actually aimed really well, but we had several planned maneuvers to get the spacecraft more accurately towards the landing site as we get closer to Mars and we understand the navigation, you know, relative to Mars even better. So this one last night was our fourth one. And it was successful as far as we can tell now. We're still tracking the spacecraft.
Sure.
And if it turns out that this was a really accurate maneuver last night, it could be our last one that we need.
You know, we have all sorts, as you know, having been out here for the launch, we have all sorts of traditions out here about launch. And after a successful launch or the shuttle launch, when we used to have beans all the time, and there's any number of superstitions. I didn't know until very recently I read the feature about you guys in Air and Space magazine about this thing about the peanuts, that you guys like to eat peanuts before every landing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I'm not the expert to tell you the history there. This is actually my first Mars landing as a JPL employee, but
yeah,
I learned the same thing. You know, I saw these guys eating peanuts even in our rehearsals. All the peanuts went around, and they're planning to do it again. From what I understand, it's a real Mars tradition. It doesn't go beyond to other missions.
Wow, something got a piece of good luck. Well, of course, we want to talk about the 7 minutes of terror here. You know that it's being hyped as, and I think it's absolutely a fair assessment of what you guys are going to go through. I think we're already starting to feel a little terror right now. Talk about how hard it is to land on Mars and take us through step by step what we are going to wait to hear has happened successfully a week from now.
Sure. I mean, it's just never an easy thing to land on another planet or the moon or anywhere else. I mean, these are some of the most challenging things engineering-wise that we can do as a human race. So that's, you know, not to add to the pressure.
Yeah, really. But that's with the whole world watching you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and Mars adds its own tricks, even relative to the moon, since it has this thin atmosphere. It's, as our engineers like to say, it's not thick enough atmosphere to slow you down enough and thick enough to actually cause problems and require a heat shield and those other things. So, you know, the 7 minutes of terror begins after we enter the Mars atmosphere on late Sunday night. Mm-hmm. And the first thing we do is take about 99% of our speed away through atmospheric drag. And we use this heat shield that has similar material to that's used on the space shuttle and will be used on future manned capsules by NASA.
Mm-hmm.
First time we're using this material at Mars because we're coming in a little faster than previous missions.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, we're still going a few hundred miles an hour, faster than the speed of sound on Mars. Mm-hmm. At that point, we pop a big parachute, about a 60-foot diameter parachute. It's the biggest parachute ever built for a robotic mission, and it has to inflate at supersonic speeds, so that's a challenge as well from an engineering standpoint. We hope the physics works as we expect, and that parachute slows us down even further.
Right.
The parachute, though, even in Mars atmosphere, can't slow us down enough to land safely. So especially with this big one metric ton rover, we have to take off even more speed than what the parachute can do. So the next thing that gets really exciting when you watch our animations is then the rover drops out of the parachute, attached to what we call our descent stage.
Yeah.
And this is really a whole other spacecraft that flies the rover down about the last mile to the surface. And it's a rocket-powered spacecraft, 8 rockets, that takes the rover down. And meanwhile, there's a very critical measurement we need to do with a radar. There's a 6-beam radar that needs to lock on the surface and get the altitude of the spacecraft to tell the computer how to do the rest of the descent, and also take out the horizontal velocity at that point using the radar as well.
Wow. So all this is going on. So we're like perilously close now to the surface, but you're still not there.
Yeah. We're still a mile away from the surface, 8 rockets, you know, doing their thing, and the radar locking onto the surface and tracking the descent and timing everything. And then when we get about, you know, just a few stories off the ground, we do our final, pull our final trick out of our hat, which is the sky crane maneuver. And this is something that's really was invented for this mission in terms of using it on Mars. It's inherited from helicopters and other vehicles on Earth that carry suspended loads underneath them. But we lower the rover down from the descent stage using the sky crane maneuver and place the rover down on its own wheels on Mars. And as soon as we sense that touchdown on its own wheels, those tethers are cut, and the descent stage powers up for one last flight away, safely away from the rover. And then the 7 minutes come to an end, and we hopefully are successfully on the surface.
And 14 minutes later, you'll find out yes or no.
That's right, and exactly.
Well, and you
that'll
know,
be a big moment.
This sky crane thing is kind of interesting to me because, you know, as you watch the animation – the whole thing is crazy, by the way. The whole and you know that, and we all know that, but we know that it's based on sound engineering, and it's what you have to do to meet, you know, the mission parameters. But it looks so wild, and I just can't, you know, when that rover comes out of the descent lander thing on the sky crane, it just reminds me of bungee jumping, you know.
Yeah.
It's just but there's no buoying there at the bottom, is there? There's it's, It just comes down, and then you kind of set it down here. You know, hey,
yeah, yeah.
Ashwin, my friend Anthony here in the studio today, he's got a quick question for you. Let's. What do you have?
Hi, I might not be that quick. Why did we choose to go this route after the success we had with Spirit and Opportunity? Was it because of the size of the vehicle?
That's exactly right. It's the mass, more specifically, that would just be too. We're just too heavy to use the airbags and have that cushion our final touchdown. You know, and it's funny how these things work because. Airbags were considered the crazy thing that was invented here, you know, the last time.
And it worked.
And now we consider them the safe thing.
Well, it's good that you're pushing the envelope, right? Isn't that what exploration is all about and science is all
about?
That's
exactly right. I mean, we're jumping forward with a 5 times heavier rover than ever before, and that just requires brand new engineering.
Just absolutely incredible. It's going to be and there's a great mission ahead. We're going to talk about that. Ashwin, why don't you stand by here a little bit here. We're going to take our little break. But I do want to remind everybody, too, that that we're talking about here in terms of landing on Mars. It's been done, attempted 12 times in the past. Half have been successful, half have failed. All of the successes have been U.S. Of the failures, 4 were Russian, 1 was American, and 1 was European. We've got a pretty good track record. It sounds crazy, but it makes a lot of sense in some ways. So, in any case, we're going to talk more about the science when we come back. We are going to pause now for our 5-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour. Take a break, get you caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. Then we'll be back to talk some more with Ashwin Vasavada from NASA's JPL. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. Everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Bankey.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Our phone lines and online inbox are open for your questions or comments today about the Mars Science Laboratory, the Curiosity rover. The phone number 321-768-1240 and the email address is spacetalking@aol.com. On the phone with us from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, is the Deputy Science Project. Deputy Project Scientist. Don't want to use the word manager there. Ashwin Vasavada. Ashwin's been on the program before to talk about the Curiosity rover landing on Mars next weekend. He returns with us today. And Ashwin, we just went through the 7 minutes of terror, and so now you're on the ground safe and sound. Let's start with talking about why this landing site. Where did, you know, if we were to look at Mars, I know Mars is rotating, but if we were to look up in the sky and see Mars, where is this landing site and why did you pick it?
This landing site is kind of near the equator of Mars, but it's also on what we call the Mars hemispheric dichotomy. And what that just means is
oh, that's
Mars.
Scary.
Yeah, right. It's exciting. The Mars globe, if you will, is higher in the south and lower in the north.
Yeah.
And that's a feature that formed early in Mars history, and it resulted in most of the water in early Mars flowing downhill from south to north. So a bunch of our final site candidates were on this huge planetary slope where most of the rivers on Mars were at one point. And Gale Crater, our landing site for Curiosity, is basically a big hole punched right in that sloping terrain. And so what makes it interesting is it's not just an impact crater like many others on Mars, but it's an impact crater that was once buried under miles thick of sediment. And then most of that sediment was stripped away and leaving a mountain behind in the middle of the crater. So the best, kind of a good analogy on Earth would be something like the Grand Canyon, where you have a bunch of sediment that covered entire states in the United States, and then a river cut through it and exposed the layers. And if you look at those layers, you basically have a record of time in whether it's the Southwest U.S. or Mars.
Now, Gale Crater, G-A-L-E or G-A-I-L, named for my mother.
This is G-A-L-E,
yeah.
Named for an Australian astronomer back in the day.
Back in the day. So now, big picture on the science, and as we've talked about exploring Mars through the years, we've talked about looking for life. We've talked about looking for water. And we've talked about looking for evidence that conditions existed once where life might have happened, but we haven't proved it one way or the other yet. Where does Curiosity sort of fall on that spectrum of science and kind of talk about its big picture mission?
Yeah, we are trying to answer with the entire Mars exploration program this pretty difficult question to answer, which is whether Mars ever had life or even has life today. If it has any kind of life, it's probably microbial life. Mm-hmm. And if it ever had microbial life, it probably was in its early history, that first billion or 2 years when there's all this geologic evidence and mineralogic evidence for having a lot of fresh water on the surface. So we're going to a site that we think, you know, in the layered rock at Gale Crater would give us a chance to look at those environments as they're kind of frozen in time for us in those rocks and ask the question, you know, were the conditions at Gale Crater a few billion years ago conducive to life? Mm-hmm. We don't expect to be able to detect life in those rocks, ancient life or present life. We didn't design the rover to do that, but we designed a whole suite of instruments to understand what we call the habitability of Mars. Were the ingredients for life there, and were the conditions either favorable or hazardous to any life that would have been there?
So in trying to determine if that is all true, what is the what's the aha moment? What's the, you know, what do you need to see to prove, you know, the theory that all was true? I mean, is there some big thing that you're looking for? I guess I read somewhere about, you know, you're not going to expect to see a dinosaur bone sticking out of the sand, but
right.
What will you see? What do you
hope
to see?
Yeah, you know, this is a challenging thing to answer because there's no yardstick that will tell us how habitable the site is. Instead, we take a lot of different kinds of measurements, and it's the kind of thing that, you know, would affect us as humans as well. Are the ingredients that make up our bodies, you know, present on Mars as the raw material for any life?
Mm-hmm.
Or on the other end of the equation, are there too many hazards? We'll be looking at ultraviolet light and high-energy radiation that hits Mars a lot more intensely than it hits Earth because of Mars' thin atmosphere. So, you know, we'll be building up kind of a picture of how habitable the environment was in the past. And from that, you know, I think the real result of this mission will be just getting a better sense for whether early Mars really was a place that could have supported life if it ever took hold.
Well, of course, then the big question is then, of course, what do you do with that information next? And it's always about comparing our planet to others and what can we learn about from Mars and apply it to Earth. And so that next step comes with other missions or other researchers years from now looking at data. How do you approach that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, to give you one more specific view of what we might be looking for, we do have the ability to detect organic carbon. So carbon in large molecules of the kind that make up our cells and other proteins and that stuff, things mm-hmm. like that in our bodies. Those things occur naturally and could have been delivered to Mars early in its history and been there for life to use as its raw material. So we'll be looking for that. Now, when we learn about the habitability of Gale and, you know, by proxy, a lot of Mars in its early history, we then, you know, if we have a favorable result, we would then want to go back to this site or something like it and return samples to Earth because really, one of the reasons, frankly, that we're not trying to detect life, you know, directly on Mars is that we can't miniaturize the huge laboratories that would be necessary to make that determination
sure.
and put them on a spacecraft.
I want to ask you about the instruments in a moment. I want to ask you, though, too, if you would remind us, what do we know about Mars? I mean, first of all, do we know for sure there's water there, that there was water? I think we know there was water there. Do we know that there's water there now?
Yeah, you know, and what's really intriguing is when we look at the pictures of Mars from orbit, you can see rivers that dry now, but they once ran hundreds and hundreds of miles, you know. So, and then we're finding more detailed evidence of things like shorelines of lakes or sediments laid down in lakes. A delta was discovered and was actually one of our landing sites we didn't end up choosing, a river delta, now, you know, dry and frozen in rock. So we are, you know, very sure at this point that there was a lot of water in Mars' early history. And today we know that there's water making up polar caps that are a few miles thick and frozen permafrost around those polar caps and a little tiny bit in the atmosphere. But what's missing is the key liquid water at the surface.
And at that point, then we say, life. We don't know that it exists yet. We don't know that it was there because we can't prove that yet one way or the other.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
We don't know yet with all the science that we've done on Mars. The question of whether there was life or is life of any form on Mars is still unanswered.
Yes. I mean, that really is what drives us. You know, you can say that about everything besides Earth. You know, the only life we know of in the universe right now is our own. And so Mars gives us, you know, by being kind of our neighbor down the block, we can send spacecraft there relatively quickly. And we know that Mars had this special environment a few billion years ago with all this fresh water on the surface. So it's probably our most likely and most easily accessible place to find life outside of Earth, and that's what makes it so exciting to go send these spacecraft.
Ashwin, my friend Anthony got a question here for you.
Mm-hmm. Hi. Do any of these the robots and robotic labs that we send up there, is it done with the idea that water arrived on Mars via comet, like in that sense, like how did the water get there? Does that take into account when you're putting together the kind of the experiments that you're going to be doing?
In a sense, we do carry a very detailed analytical chemistry experiment, which will tell us how much, you know, if we find any water, probably in the form of minerals that have water incorporated in them. We can actually look at chemical isotopes as well, and these are heavier or lighter versions of the same chemical elements. And when you look at isotopes on Earth, we've learned that you can tell something about the history that water has seen. And water delivered by comets may have a different isotopic composition than water delivered by other means, or water that's been cycling in the planet for over and over. So that's one way we'll be able to address the issue of where the water may have come from.
And can we say where the water went based on any of the experiments or any instruments you've got on board?
You know, one thing that's really great about Gale Crater and this what we were talking about earlier with this huge stack of layered sediments is that we believe, you know, our hypothesis is that Gale, having such a huge stack of sediments, and having minerals that require fresh water to form at the bottom of the stack and then transitioning to just dry dust at the top of the stack, our hypothesis is that mound has captured that entire transition from wet early Mars to dry present-day Mars. And so we'll be able to get a better kind of geologic story than anything before, you know, by driving the rover kind of through time up this mound. And then actually a follow-on mission called MAVEN, which launches in 2013, we'll be looking at the mechanisms that we think resulted in the loss of water, which is really the sun, the solar wind, stripping away Mars' atmosphere including the water slowly. So, you know, we kind of have a two-pronged approach. We'll get the story from the surface, and MAVEN will look at how the atmosphere was lost as a whole, which then made water unstable on the surface.
Yeah, and I think we've just now started getting into why we think it'll be so important to send people up there someday. Ashwin, we're going to take our final break of the day. Stand by. We'll be right back with you, and we will wrap up our discussions of the week. Plus, take a look at our local launch forecast. Again, more with Ashwin Vasavada from JPL. Talking about the Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity landing 1 week from tonight. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. This is Space Talk with Jim Bankey.
And again, welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk with a quick reminder that you can stay in touch with us throughout the week. If you're on Facebook, just search for Space Talk. If you're on Twitter, look for Space Talking. And for one-stop shopping, visit WMMBAM.com, keywords Space Talk. Before we get back to Mars, let's continue with a look at our local launch forecast. Preparations at Launch Complex 41 at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station do remain on track to support the launch of United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket. August 23rd will be a flight managed by Kennedy Space Center's Launch Services Program. The Atlas V is to carry a pair of NASA science satellites into Earth orbit, and it's called the Radiation Belt Storm Probes mission. This mission of, again, a pair of satellites will study the effects of space weather on the Van Allen radiation belts that surround our planet, and, of course, which can in turn affect us here on Earth. So very important to learn some more about that. The launch time is a nice and early 4:08 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So once again, we should get a great show of a night launch here over the Cape. By the way, before the United Launch Alliance team can send that Atlas V on its way from the Cape, they will spend some time on the West Coast this week launching an Atlas V from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. The Atlas V there is scheduled to lift off this coming Thursday morning, 3 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, midnight local out there. The booster will be carrying yet another secret payload for the National Reconnaissance Office. Of course, for more information about this and all the various launches scheduled around the world, including the launch planned Wednesday from Kazakhstan with the next Progress cargo flight to the International Space Station, do jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, and look for the link to our launch forecast. Well, again, we've been talking today about the Mars Science Laboratory about to land on Mars here next Sunday night, Monday morning, depending on what time zone you're in the United States. It's going to be the biggest deal, I think, in space all year. Ashwin Vasavada, the deputy project scientist for the mission, is on the phone with us from Pasadena at JPL. And Ashwin, I wanted to ask you real quick about the logistics of the spacecraft itself once it's on the ground, and give us an idea of its capability as this sort of this car-sized rover. How far will it go? How fast will it go? How often will it go? Give us a sense of what the mission will be like.
Sure. You know, when we first touch down, we spend a few weeks checking everything out. This is the most complex spacecraft JPL has ever built. It's really like it has more in common with things like Cassini, these giant bus-sized orbiters that we send out to the outer planet. You know, more in common with that kind of complexity than the previous Mars rovers. So this is a flagship mission we're sending to the surface of Mars, car-sized rover, a radioisotope power source to make it independent of the sun and no need for solar panels.
Sure.
It's a two-year mission, so we're really keeping that in mind. There's no rush to, you know, get things done. We're going to deliberately check everything out and then start making our way to the mound inside of Gale Crater where these fantastic layers are. We're going to operate the rover in kind of a series of ways where we first take images of our surroundings with our HD color cameras. We'll put out a 7-foot robotic arm and kind of scratch and sniff some rock surfaces and soils if we find them interesting. Similar to previous rovers, we have a microscopic camera. And then the real special thing about this rover and why it's so big is our ability to acquire powder from the insides of rock with a big jackhammer drill and analyze that powder inside two analytical chemistry laboratories in the rover.
Carrying that all around with you all the time, how often do you think you'll be able to move this thing?
It'll be pretty similar to the Mars exploration rovers, I think. You know, we'll stay in place for a few weeks at a given rock outcrop or interesting feature, and then we'll, you know, drive for a few weeks and then stay in place again.
Yeah. Hey, we don't have a lot of time here left in our segment remaining. I want to ask you real quick, though, as a scientist, and then we talked a little bit about this a couple of years ago, but I was curious if you would again tell us, why is Mars particularly intriguing to you, and why do you think it should be particularly intriguing to the rest of us?
You know, to me, it's just because it really is the most Earth-like planet in the solar system other than Earth. And that has implications for a lot of things, not just the prospects for finding life that we discussed earlier, but also the similarities and just how the planet works with an atmosphere, with a climate system that has similarities to ours, and having undergone a massive climatic shift in its past. So all those things will teach us about not only Earth, but about the solar system in general.
Ashwin, I want to ask you a real quick question here from a caller here, Richard from Satellite Beach with a question. Richard, welcome to Space Talk.
Thank you.
What's your question, sir, real quick?
My question is, we discovered helium-3 on the moon. It looked, conditions were ideal, you know, it was being generated by the bombardment on the sun. But due to Mars' atmosphere and the dust storms they have you got a... any instrumentation on this probe in order to determine what the possibilities are for helium-3?
Richard, that's actually a really good question. Ashwin, what do you think? Is there helium-3 to go mine on Mars?
Yeah, that's not something I've really thought about. You know, I'm afraid I don't really know the answer, but I'll have to look into it.
Well, I think the whole idea of in situ relation, you know, in fact, it's interesting because you also work lunar reconnaissance orbit with just about 50 seconds left here. Tell us real quick, back to the moon or on to Mars, does it matter? We need to do both?
You know, as a planetary scientist, I'll just be greedy and say we need to study all the planets to cross-compare them and learn about each other.
Amen.
The moon, you know, has really taught us a lot. From an engineering perspective, I think it's an ideal place to learn how to land on planets again with humans and make our way to Mars.
Yeah, that's absolutely outstanding. Ashwin, we do need to start wrapping it up here. I'd want to thank you so much for taking time today to be with us on the program and talk about Mars Science Laboratory, talk about Curiosity. We certainly want to extend our best wishes and good luck and a bag full of peanuts your way from the Space Coast. We launched it here, and now take it from here and do good things, and we're very excited for you, and we keep our fingers crossed. So thanks again for being on the show today.
Yeah, thanks so much, and thanks for the good wishes.
Yeah, very good. Okay, there goes Ashwin Vasavada from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and boy, it's going to be a great thing. We're going to have a lot of information about this mission on our WMMBAM.com webpage on the Space Talk page. Give you some links to what to follow the landing coverage and the 7 minute of terror video is something everybody has to see. So we'll have that all on board here for you here as the week goes on. We'll talk some more about it next weekend as well on the thing. Hey, by the time again next week on Space Talk, we will focus more on Curiosity. And we'll also get caught up on all the latest space news and whatnot, so please do tune in here in a week from now. In the meantime, don't forget our inbox at spacetalking@AOL.com. Always open for you, the one-stop shopping at WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk. And we'll keep everything updated right there for you. By the way, that is it for now. Can you believe it? Another hour already gone. Space Talk, a production of Mila Solutions, and is brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the ops station for today's program. Thanks for my buddy Anthony sitting in and asking a few intelligent questions. Please join us next Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time for another live hour of Space Talk. Again, stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of the Best of Bill Mick Live. I'm Jim Bankey, and we will talk to you again real soon.